rise. The United States Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit is now open and in session. God save the United States and this honorable court.
The trial court committed reversible error, in this case, by refusing to construe for the jury two disputed claim terms. Translation and destination error. With respect to both of them, translation and destination error. With respect to
the there were a number of claim terms that you were saying he misconstrued.
Well, I would say he failed to construe. He gave no guidance to the jury with respect to either of those terms.
With respect to each of the claim terms that you're raising, are we dealing with a situation in which you're claiming that the construction is incorrect rather than that it's wrong?
No, I don't think that's true with respect to the first two terms I've identified, which are translation, destination, address, because I think the error is one that this court has commented on repeatedly. That if there are disputed claim terms, and those two terms were disputed, they were disputed at the Markman hearing, the trial judge, not the jury, is the proper place for disputed claim terms to be decided. Here, the two terms, translation and translate, the destination address, were disputed. Vonage proposed the definition.
What you said was wrong about it. In each one of these instances, including these two, your contention, it seems to me, is that the construction was incomplete. Not that he said something that was wrong, but that he should have said more, which would be limiting to the term.
Well, it's incomplete in the sense for those two terms.
Am I correct or not correct?
Yes, you're correct, and let me answer further if I might. It's incomplete in that, for those two terms, he gave nothing. Now, with respect to some of the other terms, for example, his definition of local wireless gateway system, he gave a completely meaningless and ambiguous definition. For that term, he gave a definition that said a limited or local area. That provides no guidance, no assistance to the jury. So it's not that it's incomplete, it's ambiguous and provides no guidance. So we've got situations with respect to two claim terms where the trial court erred in a way that this court has repeatedly said is an error, to not construe disputed claim terms. He didn't construe them at all. He said nothing to the jury about the meaning of either of those terms. And the mischief that that permitted was evidenced by one of the early questions that the jury asked, which was, can you give us guidance with respect to the meaning of translation? There was a dispute as to what translation meant. We believe that the construction that we gave was consistent and in plain language meaning as understood by one of ordinary skill in the art. There was no dispute.
So all of your contentions with respect to the 574 and the 711 patent terms involve contentions that the embodiments disclosed in the specification should result in a limiting of the claim term. Isn't that true with respect? That's across the board argument, each one of the claim terms.
It's partial.
In 574 and 611.
711, yes. 711. That's partially true, but it's incomplete. In the sense that we do make the observation that with respect to the claim constructions that we offer, that our claim constructions do not read out any of those embodiments. But that's not the basis of our construction. If you go through each of the constructions that we have offered, with respect to conditional analysis is a good example. Conditional analysis is not a plain and ordinarily understood mean. It was disputed. And so in a case where you don't have a plain meaning to a claim term, you are required under the teachings of this court to go to the specification. And so what we did in that instance for our claim definition, we have a disputed claim term. It's not a plain language claim term.
But what is there in addition to the embodiments argument, which we seem to have rejected in Phillips, with respect to any of those claim terms in the 574 and 711?
Well, with respect to conditional analysis specifically, the present invention language, which this court has regularly said, when you have not a plain language term, and you are required to go to the specification, the first place you go is to the present invention language. And with respect to the 711 and 574, we've gone to the present invention language with respect to the definition of conditional analysis. And we've quoted in our briefs.
What does the present invention language say about conditional analysis?
Well, with respect, we believe that the present invention language indicates that it's consistent with the, I've misspoken here. Let me try to correct that. We think that with respect to conditional analysis, the argument that we've made is consistent with the prior art that's described. In the present invention language.
The present invention language, I thought, was with respect to terms in the 880 patent.
Well, it's also with respect to the 711.
What specific language?
I would like to refer you to two or three citations. Number one is column 4.
Okay, this is the 711 specification.
That's correct. Column 4, 41 to 47. And then further supporting that present language interpretation is column 5, lines 2 to 11.
What is the language in column 4?
Okay.
What exact language?
The present invention relates to an enhanced server for the translations of names and the like into address information, networks or systems utilizing such a server, and methods translating names into address information to provide customers with a wide range of sophisticated routing options, to provide customers. Now, our definition of conditional analysis is that it responds to the called party needs. It doesn't respond to the service provider needs. It doesn't respond to the calling party needs. So that's what the dispute is all about. And we think the present invention language on a non-plain language term, which talks about responding to the customer needs, particularly when read in the context of the existing domain name system, which is described there, and the AIM system, which is described earlier. Now, that's the present invention language that we refer to. But if you look further, immediately after the present invention language, and consistent with that language, at column 5, 2 to 11, the sentence begins, the called party can subscribe to a selective routing service, and selective routing service is customized to meet the subscriber's individual routing needs by customizing and routing control records that control conditional analysis responsive to translation requests relating to the customer's needs. Now, the term we're defining is conditional analysis. If you look at the specifications, the first time that word appears in the specifications is in that sentence I just read. And so the first time the inventor describes conditional analysis, immediately after the present invention language, which is talking about customer needs in the context of existing AIM telephone network customer needs and the domain name system, the first time the term is used, it talks about the called party needs. And the called party is the one that's giving routing information. Either called party say, I want my call if I'm not here to go to voicemail. Either called party, if I'm not here, want my call to go to another telephone number where I will be. And so we believe that with respect to conditional analysis, that
what respect is the monitor system not meeting the needs of the called party?
Well, we think it does meet the needs.
No, but you're saying that we should limit this.
Limit the interpretation. Well, for example, on an outbound call, the example of infringement that Verizon gave was that the call from a bondage subscriber outbound, conditional analysis takes place because there are two destination addresses given. One of those is the destination address of the party being called. But under conditional analysis, you need a first result and a second result, first destination and a second destination. And in that case, it was call block. If I, the bondage customer, have not paid my monthly bill, then the subscriber cuts off my service. That is not conditional analysis within the meaning of this patent. But that was an example.
The record shows that that's the only form of conditional analysis that's performed in the bondage system.
With respect to the outbound call, that was the only example that was given by Verizon at trial. And if we analyze the call flow back the other way with respect to inbound calls, we also believe that in those circumstances, the result is the same, particularly when you combine our definition with destination address. Because destination address...
Leave aside destination address on the inbound calls, what's the conditional analysis in the bondage system?
Well, the argument would be that the conditional analysis is that the bondage system gives a one result or another result with respect to inbound calls. And in those circumstances, we believe that if that situation is analyzed, that you would not have the conditional analysis resulting in a destination address, which is an endpoint. So we read the terms together. And so if you read the terms together, destination address and conditional analysis, you would not have infringement as described.
But that depends on our agreeing with your definition of destination.
The example I gave certainly does that in that instance. So,
Mr. Laren, while you're on the destination address issue, ELED submitted a request to the court for a definition limiting the address to the, quote, the final endpoint of packet network.
That's correct.
The court rejected that and said it should be just a standard definition that is well known by the jury, so there was no definition that you had submitted that you accepted. How does that definition help your understanding of 7-Eleven, patent 7-Eleven? Why would not the bondage use of the ID system then still be a destination address which would be infringing under the 7-Eleven?
Well, under the 7-Eleven patent, which is the one that requires conditional analysis. And if you look specifically at the terms of the 7-Eleven patent, it requires that there be a first destination address and a second destination address. And that destination address, the first and second, must be used for establishing communications at least partially through the public packet data network. Now, with respect to our definition, a destination address. We think that there would be, I'll get back to your exact question in a minute, no infringement with respect to the 574. Now, with respect to the 7-Eleven, with respect to destination address, we believe that there's a difference in call flow with respect to how you would analyze it, and that there are intermediate addresses that are given, the RTP relay, of the access to the voicemail system and things of that sort, which are not the endpoint of the public packet data network. When you analyze what happened here at trial, and I noticed that my light is on, so I'll finish answering the question. You analyze here what happened at trial. The fight was about whether or not an undefined term, destination address, the judge gave no guidance at all. It's important to look at the difference between the Markman instruction and the ruling and the trial court ruling, because in neither place with respect to destination address does the court give a definition of destination address. But it was disputed. We argued that intermediate hops, RTP relay, voicemail access, those were the results of the translation, were not a destination address. And so that if the result of the translation is an intermediate address and not final address, then we would not be infringing. And so under our interpretation, if you go through the call flow with respect to a substantial number of calls, under that analysis, if we had gotten the instruction there would have been a more articulated presentation of evidence for the jury so the jury could decide whether or not there were any infringing calls. But given the fact that the judge failed to define it at all, the jury was left to hear Verizon's experts saying that intermediate hops could be a destination address, which we believe, we pointed out, is directly inconsistent with the specification, which distinguishes intermediate hops from the destination address.
Intermediate in the sense of the RTP?
Yes.
Use RTPs in all of your systems?
The RTP relay is used in what's called a NATed environment, where the ultimate address, the IP address of the user, is not revealed in the message that's sent back, and all that is revealed, it's like it's cloaked. All that is revealed is the intermediate address, and then you go to that intermediate address, and that RTP relay then forwards it on. And there are a very substantial number of Vonage subscribers that the method in which they've chosen to subscribe to the Vonage system is in a NATed environment, cloaked environment, so that the ultimate destination is not, the IP address is not revealed to the calling party. That same thing would be true with respect to other intermediate stops that operate. We have a dispute with Verizon as to whether or not voicemail is a final destination. That's a second example from our point of view of an intermediate destination, because the voicemail system is not the endpoint on the public packet data network. It is just an access point to further endpoints, which are voicemail servers provided by our voicemail service provider, which is a service that is outsourced.
But the voicemail address, would that be the second destination address?
Yes, but it would not be an end. Yes, it would be a second destination address. Absolutely correct. We don't dispute that. But the second destination address, in our definition, has to be an end, not an intermediate. And so the dispute was not one that you see argued about a little bit in the briefs as to whether or not destination address could include the destination telephone. We don't dispute that it could include, and in fact, the patent specifically says it can include the destination telephone number. So that wasn't what this dispute was about at trial. It's whether or not the phrase in the patent, destination address, in the 711, which was defined in the claim 20, as an IP address, whether or not that was an intermediate IP address, the in effect routing or intermediate hops or stops, as we had to stay hearing the example of Philadelphia, the train going through Philadelphia on the way to New York. And it's our contention that if you understand those two terms, which were not defined, destination address and translating, as they would have been understood by one of ordinary skill in the art, not a layperson, there was not a dispute between the parties as to what was necessary for one of ordinary skill in the art. It was agreed that you needed a computer science or computer engineering degree. It was agreed that you needed 2 to 5 years experience in either internet telephony or the telephone system. So the question is to allow a lay jury that doesn't have that background. Lay juries do not constitute one of ordinary skill in the art when you're dealing with technology such as this. To allow a lay jury to speculate as to what the terms destination address and intermediate translated with no guidance from the court allows for the kind of mischief we have.
But what about the fact that you didn't object? I mean, you're arguing for this utility exception, which does exist in some circumstances, but if I understand your argument correctly, to have a claim construction hearing where 40 terms are construed, no objection to the jury instructions, and then the jury verdict becomes vulnerable if we on appeal decide that any one of those 40 terms was construed wrong at the market.
I think the important consideration, it's a very fair question, Judge Dyke, is what's the purpose of the futility doctrine? And as this court has said, and I believe in the opinions that you made yourself as author, that the idea is, was the trial judge fully and fairly advised of the arguments of the parties so that he had an opportunity to consider? There's no question that happened here.
What about my hypothetical? Let's suppose there are 40 claim construction terms. that are construed. Add a mark in here. Does the jury verdict become vulnerable if there's a mistake in any one of those, even though it wasn't raised at the charge conference?
I believe that that's consistent with this court's reading of the futility doctrine. I think it's also consistent.
Do you have to go that far to help you here?
Well, I don't think you have to go that far to help me, because you only have, we don't have, thank God, your hypothetical. We simply have, well, the difference is the starting point that I had here today, which is there are two claim terms that were not defined. And so this court has regularly said that it is not the business of a jury to be defining claim terms as they would be understood by one of ordinary skill in the art when they are disputed. And so with respect to those two, I think it's a fairly easy inquiry. And then we have a limited number of claim terms beyond that. So if the question was, and I think this ultimately ought to be the question for the court, would it have made any difference? The reason that the rule exists is so the trial judge has an opportunity to change his mind. Well, under these circumstances, there can be no doubt that Judge Hilton wasn't going to change his mind. He had the opportunity to consider the briefs. He had the opportunity to make his Markman ruling. He, in fact, for his Markman ruling, simply took substantial portions of the Verizon brief and adopted it as his rule. And so the notion that if we had objected, it would have saved this court some work because the trial judge might have reached a different conclusion is really not likely in these circumstances.
Well, I don't think that's exactly the point. I think the question is, at the end of the trial, after the evidence is in, and you know what the disputes are between the parties, doesn't counsel owe it to the trial judge to say, these are the key issues that still matter, and we want you to instruct the jury in these five respects so that the judge knows what the focus of the dispute is on. He doesn't have to worry about 40 claim terms coming back to haunt him on appeal.
Well, in that hypothetical, or the hypothetical court's given with 40 claim terms, you may reach a different conclusion. That's not this situation. But let me be very clear. The decision as to whether or not the futility doctrine applies, as this court pointed out in Echolab, is a decision for this court to decide whether that doctrine applies in the various circuits. And so you look to see whether or not the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals has recognized the futility doctrine. They have. And in recognizing that, in the College State decision, they talk about the same factors I've discussed here this morning, was the issue is, was the trial judge fully or fairly involved? In cardiac pacemakers, we had a situation very similar to this. There was a Markman hearing, there was a Markman ruling, it took place before the trial, there was no objection at the charge, and at that point the court found that it was not necessary, it was futile to have done so. Further evidence of the futility came when we had a question from the jury with respect to this issue of transit. And at that time, Mr. Doyle said, Your Honor, as you know, we dispute and continue to dispute your Markman rulings. And the response was, right. And so the likelihood that in this circumstance there would have been a change of the trial judge's positions is, as I say, remote in the extreme. I see my red light's on, so thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. We'll restore the rebuttal time you sought to reserve. Mr. Toronto, we'll hear from you now, and you're entitled to 28 minutes for Perry.
Thank you, Your Honor. If I may, I'd like to start briefly with this jury instruction point. The fact is, this court's Serio-US case remains the closest case about waivers on failure to object to jury instructions on claim construction issues. It's the only case involving both Fourth Circuit law and the post-2003 Rule 51. It also is a case in which this court limited review to plain error despite the fact that the issues were fully presented to the court. In fact, they were pending before the court. The claim construction issues were pending. That's not enough. What's important In all of the cases that talk either about futility, and I should mention, there is no case yet in any appellate court involving futility under the post-2003 Rule 51. But passing that, the only cases cited here by Vonage are the City of Richmond case from the Fourth Circuit, which rejected the futility exception where there was no basis in anything the district court had said to indicate that it was futile,
yeah,
even though the rule...
I'll tell you what their problem is. It's hard to reconcile Serio with some of these other cases. Someone reading the case law as at the time of this jury trial could have thought, once you agree, could have thought that it was sufficient to have raised the issue at the Markman hearing.
I think somebody reading them at the time would have first said, the rule has changed. It's now the 2003 version of Rule 51, which even more says appears to provide the exclusive means for challenging failures to incorrect jury instructions or omissions from jury instructions. So all the cases predate 2003. But in addition, if you go and look at the cases, for example, the two cases from this court, the Cardiac case and the CollegeNet case, CollegeNet itself says at 1234 that there was an objection made in the jury instruction papers. Cardiac says sometimes a resolution of claim construction issues before the trial can be enough to render it futile, but it doesn't say why it was there. So if you then go look at the appellee's brief, you will see expressly that the court there said during trial, this is final, admonished counsel to stop arguing about it and told the jury that issue was over and done with. Nothing like that happened here.
You know, something somewhat similar happened here, didn't it? I mean, in the sense that, as you look at page 4 of the slide, during deliberations, it said they objected to claim construction and continues to object.
That was, of course, after the case had gone to the jury. They are referring explicitly there to the discussion when the jury came back with a note, by which time, of course, it is too late. And of course, what the old rule said, what the new rule says is you have to make your objections before the jury retires. Serio U.S. is explicit about that carrying forward into the new rule. That citation is post-deliberation.
Degree of specificity do you need to make the objection? They had submitted their own jury instructions.
Yes.
They were rejected by the court.
There were no claim constructions in those jury instructions, Your Honor. None at all.
There were no claim constructions requested by them on the jury instructions?
That's exactly correct. You look in the joint appendix, their proposed jury instruction says, here's the language of the claims, nothing about claim construction, not there. That might well have been enough had they then said, in the proposed jury instructions, here's what we think the claim constructions ought to be. They didn't. Now, under the new Rule 51, the rule pretty much explicitly says, even that might not be enough. You also have to object unless the judge on the record has already rejected the proposed jury instruction. But they did not do that here. That's why this is a quite naked case of no presentation of the claim construction issues in the jury instruction process before the jury retired.
But you're not arguing under the waiver of the Markman hearing provisions. You're arguing that under Rule 51 they had to make specific jury instruction requests.
Right. There are two separate kind of waiver points. One is selective as to particular claim constructions. The other is a global point about the jury instructions. So let me mention the one other case that's discussed here. There are these two Fourth Circuit cases, the City of Richmond one, which expressly says, although under the old rule there is a futility exception, it is not enough to simply assert that it would be futile, and so they applied plain error review. The other one, the College Loan case, is a peculiar case because it involved a pre-trial disposition of claims, a pre-trial dismissal, which of course was independently appealable after a final judgment, quite without regard to what the later jury verdict was. The appellant was entitled to say some of our claims were dismissed, we're entitled to get back those claims by reversing the preemption ruling. And once you did that, of course, the jury verdict on a truncated set of claims had to be set aside. So it's not really a Rule 51 case at all. We, of course, don't have a pretrial disposition of any claim. So what we have here is Serio U.S. as, I think, far and away the closest case.
You do have a denial, though, by the judge of refusing to interpret certain claims of language, both the translation and the destination address.
I don't think that's right, because what the judge said to the jury expressly was these terms take on their ordinary meaning. That is, it's not a separate and express construction, but it's not a refusal to construe and say,
but at the Markman hearing, he did refuse to, especially to accept Blanche's specific determination on those two claim language.
Yes, so he rejected both of their constructions on destination address and conditional analysis.
Right. So on that basis, is that really a waiver at that point in time?
I think for
the needs to be carried over to the jury.
I think for the jury instruction purposes, it is the point, as I think Judge Dyke was mentioning, of this really quite strict Rule 51 about jury instruction is that let me talk about it in the context of claim construction. This court has said in the Jack Gutman case that rolling claim constructions are permitted. The court has said in the Wilson Sporting Goods case that Vonage cites in its reply brief that determining exactly what the claim construction ought to be and which issues require clarification is importantly informed by the record of what's being accused. That makes it all the more important to get a final, clear set of objections made and objections resolved at that last clear chance for telling the jury what the law is. Otherwise, what you have is this process whereby you're going to get a do-over with an extraordinarily expensive trial for enforcing patent rights having to be done again because the judge wasn't told at that last moment when the law, claim construction law, was being given to the jury what exactly was being objected to by the party. That's why the earlier ruling, before any of the evidence has come in, before the judge has truly learned through the process of trial what's at stake and understood more of the process than perhaps he did at the earlier proceeding, is important. If I can turn...
At the time of the Markman hearing, there were no determinations made by the judge on those two points. And it just translated... I'm sorry. It was just pushed back to the time of the jury instruction.
No, well...
So if, in fact, the judge refused to accept the definitions that were submitted for those two terms by Vonage, is that a futility type of an aspect by requesting later on, saying, we want you to do it at that point?
No, I think there are two possibilities, if I'm understanding right. One is to read the pretrial Markman ruling as not really ruling on, not really rejecting Vonage's proposals. I don't think that's what really happened, but if that's what happened, then it's on all fours with Serio U.S., because then the judge hadn't even yet dispositively rule on those proposals, and it was all the more incumbent on Vonage to tell the judge when it came time to instruct the jury, there remains this proposal we have that you haven't quite fully rejected. I think, in fact, the better view is that he did reject Vonage's proposed claim constructions at the Markman stage, but that isn't enough to excuse the failure, even in proposing jury instructions at the beginning of the trial, let alone in the jury instruction process at the end of the trial before the case went to the jury to raise the issue again and say, Your Honor, we now understand something better. Let me try again and make clear to you why what you said before the trial isn't really, really enough. And of course, Vonage here hasn't pointed to anything in which the judge before that said, I don't want to hear any more about claim construction. Stop talking to me, right? I mean, that's what happened in the cardiac case from this court involving, I think that was Ninth Circuit law. It also hasn't pointed to anything that happened in the trial that made essentially an irreversible kind of decision, which would have made perfectly clear that the judge could not possibly have changed its claim construction along the way. What we have here is just a naked assertion that the district court, having ruled on Markman before the trial, couldn't possibly have changed what he was going to say about claim constructions when it came time to jury instruction. That, among other things, is what the Fourth Circuit City of Richmond said is not enough.
Let's talk about some of the actual claim construction.
I'd love to.
I think we understand your point.
Thank you.
The 880 patent talks about localized wireless gateway systems. And they say, if I understand correctly, that localized will be limited to a few feet, right? Based on the prosecution.
They do say that the patent ought to be limited to a few feet. There's a peculiar line at page 20 of the reply brief that says maybe that argument doesn't have to do with the term localized, but I don't really understand that sentence. So I think they really do mean localized has to be a few feet.
That's the way I read it. And you've got this prosecution history, which is a problem for you. And you've got the Microsoft case, which
yes.
You don't say too much about in your brief. They don't like the lines you cited. The Microsoft case is a problem for you, because if I understand what was said in Microsoft, it is that even if the prosecution history came, with respect to a later issued patent, your parent patent, it's still relevant to claim construction. So it seems to me that the Microsoft case says that we can and should look to this later prosecution history in which they talk about a possible few feet limitation. What's the answer to that?
We have not taken issue with the Microsoft proposition that a piece of post-issuance prosecution history can accomplish, as Microsoft said it did there, a clear disavowal. What we say is that this one didn't. By looking at the particular pieces of prosecution history, there are only two statements. Right. They're at 7189 and 7191 of the appendix. The first one is unambiguously only exemplary. It says, such as, for example. Talks about cordless phones, such as, for example. It's not limiting. It's unambiguously not limiting. The other one is the one that I think it is fair to say might well be ambiguous. But ambiguity isn't enough. What that one says is it refers to the local wireless in the sense of a cordless phone that is restricted to operate within a few feet from a base station. A better reading, but it only has to be one reasonable reading, is that means a cordless phone in the sense in which a few feet range cordless phone and its base station are a localized system. It's giving the cordless phone as an example of the kind of island-like system that the patent otherwise repeatedly talks about as the defining characteristic of at least the localized wireless gateway system. So even that language is at best ambiguous. In fact, I think it's better read to simply mean a cordless example in the sense in which the cordless phone is that kind of island-like system. And there are a couple of reasons for that. One is that, as Vonage accepts, the prior art being distinguished doesn't talk about numerical ranges. So it would be sort of surprising to find that somehow a numerical range was being asserted as a limitation here when that wasn't part of what you needed to be distinguished. And of course, the other reason is that it's much more natural to think that the statement in this prosecution history has the same meaning that the specification is otherwise conveying, which is, on the one hand, we have wide area coverage systems like cellular systems, and that's not what we're talking about. On the other hand, we have these island-like systems in which wireless coverage is limited to some kind of area with vast, in an ocean of non-covered areas. So I think that this statement simply cannot rise to the level of a clear disavowal. It may well be, I think that's really our point on that. We're not contesting.
What about the present invention language in the 880 patent with respect to the plurality of base stations and compression technologies?
Right. Those points come down to this column 4, present invention language. And as you'll know from our brief, we think that in this case, that doesn't rise to the level that, for example, the Honeywell case involved, where Honeywell had an unambiguous statement, this invention relates to fuel filters. And what happened later was that in a divisional application, a restriction not based on fuel filter versus something else, but rather on the kind of material being used, Honeywell, in the course of the later prosecution, changed the language from the material to suddenly expand it to fuel injection components, fuel injection system components beyond fuel filters. And so it had an unambiguous statement, this relates to fuel filters, and the court held Honeywell to that. What we have here is something that, A, on its face, is not that kind of unambiguous statement. It says, in one aspect, the present invention involves these things. So on its face, not as ambiguous. Continue on to the other points. Undisputed between the experts here that a person of skill in the art would know, as the patent says with respect to computers, computers that can download Vonage's soft phone software to operate wirelessly, the computers can already do the compressing. So you wouldn't think that this patent was limited in some way to devices that couldn't themselves do the compressing. Next, of course, what you have is continuing on in column 4. The first one says, in one aspect, the present invention does this. It then describes other aspects. And the PTO first office action recognizes what we have here are independent and distinct inventions. And they restrict them. And contrary to what Vonage says, they don't restrict them because one is a method and one is a system. In the ordinary law of patents, that's not a good enough reason to impose a restriction requirement. In fact, the examiner said one invention, the localized wireless gateway system, belongs in one class and subclass, I think 370 and some subclass, and the other one belongs in a different class and subclass. If you just look at those classes and subclasses, both of them involve both systems, apparatuses, and methods on both sides. So there's not a distinction here being made in the restriction requirement between methods on the one hand and systems on the other hand. It's a substantive distinction about the subject matter of the two different inventions that underlie the restriction. And one involves this home location registration database and the process of registering. That's ours. And the other involves the localized wireless gateway system that eventually became the 497 patent, which is not at issue here. So those reasons all indicate that this is not a strong enough kind of present invention language to fall into that narrow class of cases like Honeywell. The final point, of course, which I want to make is as to both of these points, the compression point and the plurality of base station points. If you look at the original claims in the patent, you'll see that the language separately addresses those. It says a localized wireless gateway system with a packet service gateway that also compresses, or that also involves a plurality of base station transceivers. Phillips indicates the power, both within particular claims, among independent and dependent claims, and among two different independent claims, of the distinction when a patentee uses language A and B. B is typically not implied into A. So
do you agree that plurality means more than one?
We haven't disputed that here. In the ordinary course, I think it does, yes. And I should say, there is nothing as to that particular piece, the plurality of base station receivers, that in any way seems to relate to what the home location registration database invention is about. Recall, as Vonage stressed in its reply brief, the home location registration database is about finding the gateway. And we're not talking here about how many different gateways you have. Vonage says that within a particular gateway system, you have to have multiple base station receivers. How many base station receivers are attached to the particular packet service gateway has nothing to do with any of the elements of this claim and using the home location registration database, which is the invention claimed in the 880, as opposed to the one in the 497, as to which there are also reasons to suggest there wouldn't be this necessity, necessary limitation. But at least there, one couldn't, one would have to say, well, the description of this first aspect of the present invention in column 4 at least applies to the invention being claimed in that patent. Here we don't even have that.
I have a question for you about the injunction issue. Yes.
Can I make sure. Just a couple of points about the 5747 letter before we get to it? If you look at on the 574 and the 711 and ask what kind of conditional analysis is being talked about, there is no present invention language there that limits it. And indeed, there's a specific example, the drugstore example at column 15, line 55 to 65, where it's perfectly clear that the caller's need is being served. And when column 4, as Mr. Warren described, refers to customers, it doesn't say that customers have to be on the receiving end of the call. The customers can be, in fact, the makers of the call. The other two quick points. Ask the question, what prejudice is there from any error that there might have been about either conditional analysis or destination address? We, in our red brief, said, Bonnish hasn't shown what the prejudice is. So in their reply brief, they come back, and as to each of the patents, they say, here's what the prejudice is. As to 574 and 711, it's at page 15 of the reply brief. At page 15 of the reply brief, they don't mention a single aspect of prejudice for the conditional analysis for inbound calls. So this is, remember, a all or nothing jury verdict per patent. It's also all or nothing as to damages per patent. So even if they were right about conditional analysis being restricted to the call party's needs, they don't even say in their reply brief that all of the voicemail and call forwarding and other services for inbound calls to Vonage customers are somehow outside conditional analysis. Same thing for destination address.
Before you run out of time,
please, I'm sorry. Sorry for the detour.
I got to ask my question about the injunction. We have a bit of a new world here. They say no injunction, you say injunction. But isn't there kind of a middle ground in these cases where the injunction would put somebody out of business? Shouldn't that be a consideration in framing the injunction? Shouldn't the district court perhaps allow time for a workaround as part of the injunction? In other words, your interest, Verizon's interest, is in not losing customers. I'm not sure Verizon has interest in putting Vonage out of business. Shouldn't the district court, under these circumstances, consider whether the injunction should be framed in such a way as to allow a reasonable time for a workaround, particularly where, as here, it's non-workable infringement?
I don't think so, but let me start by saying I don't recall that there's any challenge on that ground.
No, I don't think they raised that issue, but okay. They did say that there should be no injunction, that the reasonable royalty was sufficient, and you're saying the opposite. And I'm just wondering if there's some middle ground in these cases where the injunction would put somebody out of business, whether the district court shouldn't, under those circumstances, consider whether the injunction should be limited in such a way that there is time for a workaround.
Well, in this case, of course, as a de facto matter in the stay process, there has been.
Yeah, but that doesn't really answer my question.
No. I think in the abstract, I can imagine a process whereby the adjudicated infringer goes into the court and says, give us some time. And I think the judge ought to say, look, you have to show me some reason to expect that time is going to produce the result you're after, which is to stay in business with a non-infringing result. Show me something. Don't just say, you know, give me a few months. Show me. And that, of course, didn't happen. It's only in various kinds of public statements that Vonage has been telling the world that maybe or maybe not it has a workaround. But it did not. In fact, it said very much the opposite to the district court. It said, you enjoin us, we're dead. So at a minimum, I think the kind of middle ground you're talking about.
No, that's inconsistent with this. They said, you enjoin us, we're dead. But that didn't address the question of whether they wouldn't be dead if they had time for work.
Well, except they, what they said to this court in the stay declaration of Mr. Mimikos and Mr. Rigo was a kind of carefully worded, well, we don't seem to have anything on the horizon yet. But it seems to me at a minimum to suggest that there is that kind of middle ground with it, that a district court would be abusing its discretion to deny, which is, I think, what would have to happen here. I think the adjudicated infringer would have to come in and say, here's some real-world, realistic basis for the promise of there being a workaround so that the ultimate harm is one that can be stopped here through some sort of rule that the injunction takes effect in 4 months or something. But I think an open-ended, give us some time, but we have no idea whether the time does anything except continue the uncompensable harm, I think that that would be an abuse of discretion, because the fact is that the royalty doesn't even cover the lost future profits from the fully lost landline customers, that is, which is the only subset of...
Which you never asked. Never asked.
Oh, I'm sorry?
I don't think you ever asked for those, did you?
Oh, there was no dispute that in this case there was not going to be a ruling that there would be future infringement, and we're therefore entitled to get future damages. Nobody disputed that there was going to be no ruling about somehow reducing to a present dollar value a loss of future profits, which nobody knew was going to occur, because it was entirely possible that Vonage could stop infringing. So the only question was, retrospectively, there was no lost profits claim, just a royalty because of the structure of the corporations. And the only other thing was that we said we would like the jury to specify a royalty rate for the future, not saying that we would be limited to that, but that's a statutory minimum that might, depending on its size, be enough to cover future harm to this class of customers, or might not. Nobody can find a statement where Verizon said, we hereby waive all claims to all the future harm, including the future lost profits. It just didn't occur. All that happened was the specification of the minimum statutory reasonable royalty for use if that was in fact going to be enough.
Time has expired.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Aaron.
Thank you. I'll be brief and try to address those points that were raised by the argument by Mr. Toronto. Waiver. Serio is clearly distinguishable in the circumstances here. Let's go through the reasons why. Number one, there was no Markman hearing in Serio. Number two, there was no Markman order issued before trial. Here, there was both a Markman hearing, where the judge had the opportunity to ask questions and counsel. He informed the judge beyond the briefs as to what their arguments were, and there was a Markman order well in advance of trial. Secondly, this trial was conducted pursuant to evidentiary rulings consistent with that Markman order. An example, Verizon was permitted to cross-examine Vonage's expert witness with cross-examination that asked him what his definition of translating and then was permitted over objection to say, and isn't it true, sir, that the judge rejected that definition? We objected to that. The judge allowed that type of testimony, further confirming that he wasn't going to change his mind with respect to his Markman ruling. The last reason is that the futility doctrine, which is the one that we rely upon, was not argued or discussed in Syria. The second issue that they raised was when we did object during the course of deliberations, Mr. Toronto said that the court said it's too late. We've cited the transcript. The court did not say it's too late. The only words out of the court was the one word, right. The third argument, that the rule change made a difference. Well, the futility doctrine was not discussed in the rule before the 2003 changes. The futility doctrine is not discussed in the new rule. Mr. Toronto said that the cases that we cited were all pre-rule change. That's not exactly correct. The two of the decisions that we cited, the Echo Act decision and the cardiac pacemakers, were in fact after the rule had changed They were discussing conduct or trials that took place before the rule changed. But in neither of those cases did they say, well, this is the ruling now under the old rule, but it would be different under the new rule. And in fact, the Third Circuit in the Franklin case, which was after the rule change discussing the new rule, didn't reach a conclusion that there had been any change or elimination of the futility doctrine as a result of the rule change. With respect to the argument that you have a situation where there might be a rolling claim construction that would require you to do something at the end, and the fact that this court has said that there's no requirement of a Markman hearing, it can take place at any point or at trial. Well, that's all correct, but that didn't happen here. There was not a rolling claim construction. There was a detailed Markman hearing with literally feet of briefs and expert reports submitted ahead of time that informed the judges that each of the parties ruling. Once the trial began, the evidentiary rulings and the evidence that was presented was all consistent with what the judge had ruled in advance of trial was going to be his Markman claim constructions. There was a discussion with respect to the local wireless gateway system in response to questions by the court. I think it's very important to keep the framework of this, or else what? Take a look at the instruction that was given and see if you can honestly say that there was no error in a construction that was given that would have been understood by one of ordinary skill in the art at the time for a local wireless gateway system in this patent to mean a local or limited area. That could be anything. Totally means. It could be the metropolitan area. It could be Arlington, Virginia. It provides no guidance to the court at all, to the jury at all. So in determining whether our construction is correct or the court's construction, I don't think there's any basis. And in fact, in the briefs, you find it remarkably absent any effort by Verizon to defend the construction of the court gave, recognizing the inherent ambiguity of it. So then you're faced with a situation where it's clear that that instruction is of no guidance or help to the jury. Is ours a correct instruction? And as we said before and in our briefs, our construction is based upon what the inventor said his device was.
You have 30 seconds.
We went through the present invention language, and we went through prosecution disclaimer. So under these circumstances, we think that an injunction should not be issued. Address the last point. We think there is no irreparable harm, and Mr. Toronto even admitted now in his argument that a reasonable royalty might be sufficient under the patent laws. We believe in these circumstances where the jury was asked by Verizon for a reasonable royalty that it is sufficient and no injunction is appropriate.
Thank you. Thank you. You appeal under advice.
All rise. The Honorable Court is adjourned from day to day.